So this is Fam Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air with Tokyo Teens. And just to let you know, Tokyo Teens is composed of Jimmy B and Grammy-winning producer Billy Hume. And so we just want to welcome you to the program. This is the first interview we've done with you guys.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Thanks for having us tonight.
And we always have a sponsor, so to let everybody know, we work with Newsly.me. They're an iOS app, and they're on the Android store. And what happens is they read the news to you in a natural human voice, so you can stop scrolling and start listening. Use coupon code GHOST2021, and that does work, and you get 1 month free premium subscription to Newsly. So check it out. It's pretty cool. And they sponsor the podcast, so you can actually listen to us through the Newsly app. So you'll be able to listen to this after. And so thank you very much for you guys being on the show. It's just really cool to have new guests all the time. And you guys are significantly involved in the industry. We're going to get into that. But we actually have a video that we're going to play. We're queuing it up. And it's going to be pretty interesting to see, because your project's not out yet. So people are going to get a preview of what it sounds like before we get into the interview.
Right, right.
Okay, so I'm going to play, put you on mute, and then we'll play this, okay?
All right.
All right. Hurts too much, and we're coming back to the main interview. So that is a really great preview. You guys can hear me, right?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I love the percussion. And I love the way you do that on real percussion, because so many people are in the box mm-hmm. today. It's interesting. So maybe my first question to ask Billy is being a percussionist, is that where you started?
Yeah, I started as a drummer. When I first got in bands, I was a drummer, and mm-hmm. I don't really play drums now, but I definitely will put percussion on things that I'm producing.
Yeah, that I like that touch, because that is something I've always I spend a lot of time with like Moog analog drum machines, but I've had real drummers in my band, and there's nothing like having a human being playing percussion when you're playing live. I just I always tell bands, like, if you've never done it, you need to try that.
Absolutely.
Because it's just something that changes. I mean, it changes how I write. It changes how I play if I play with a percussionist. But I think it's very important to the sound. So one of the first things I always ask any band I talk to, I mean, you guys are working on a brand new project, is, I don't know who wants to go first. Like, when did you first get into music? If you want to get into it, or whoever wants to answer the question first.
I started probably around the age of 10 or 11. My dad was a guitar player and a bass player. So just watching him open up the guitar case, pull out the guitar and play for me, that's what got me started. So I got some guitar books and started teaching myself how to play. And so the concept of teaching yourself how to play an instrument when you don't know how to play it blows my mind.
Yeah.
But that's how it's done.
So your dad didn't want to step in. He just let you kind of do it on your own.
No, he didn't want me to ruin my life. He wanted me to get a job and make something of myself.
Oh, so he wasn't.
But I showed him. So everything took off from there. If you have any talent at all and any interest to develop, that you're gonna stay with it. And it's like a lot of musicians say, you didn't choose music, it chose you.
Yeah, it's true,
right? So, and that's what happened to me. And I'm sure I can speak for Billy as well.
Well, actually, my mom wanted me to take piano lessons.
Oh, she did?
Yeah, I was like 12 or 13. And this was back in the 70s. Piano wasn't cool back then.
Yeah.
And I was living on an army base. I lived in Germany. And we're walking through this building, and they had like a nightclub for the soldiers. And she was talking about piano lessons, and I looked in this door, and it was the daytime. They're like, the bar wasn't open, but there was somebody cleaning up, and there was a stage, and they had these cool lights, and there was a drum set on the stage. And I remember looking at that going, drums are cool. So I just kind of said, hey, instead of piano, can I take drum lessons instead? I just said it because the drums look cool. And she said, sure. So that's how I started playing. It was kind of just so I didn't have to take piano lessons.
Yeah, I mean, the 70s was kind of like the age of the star drummer, like the Keith Moons and the John Bonhams.
Oh yeah,
Mitch Mitchell and guys like that. Like, I was always like drawn to Keith because I loved the way that he had this total abandon. You know, that he wasn't keeping time like Ringo, that was like, to me, like the Pooh were like the first punks, because of that kind of punk attitude that they had. I think the drums is something that my parents wouldn't let me do it, so I got on the piano. But then I went and tried to change it by getting into synths and finding like used like Moogs and stuff, and Jupiter 4s I could find and try to use them. And I just when the MTV showed up and I see all these bands using like Jupiter 4s and the Prophet 5s and Jupiter 8s, I'm like, yeah, that's it. And I was just be at Guitar Center trying to jump on a DX7.
Yeah, they're classics now.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's it. This is what we need to do. But yeah, it's just interesting. I always felt, do you feel like music, you were going to do it to feel, that it's something that's inside of you, or you were tapping into something that you said it found you, but did you feel like when you write your own music that it just comes like it's just natural and you just have to do it? Is it like a driven thing?
It is. It's, and some songs come easier than other ones. Some of them just fall in your lap with little effort. Those are gifts from above for sure. And then other ones, you just have to stay with them and hammer at these songs. until you finish them, and they're a little more stubborn. But it's really cool because you get to say what you want to say.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that is songs, if you're a good lyricist, you can write lyrics that can be reinterpreted in any way that the listener chooses to. So you're saying something, but they're free to reinterpret if they want to. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's the cool thing about being a singer-songwriter is I was always drawn to, like, you know, Dylan and Neil Young and the density of their lyrics, but then how people interpret them. And then even like sometimes I've watched a Scorsese film and like Dylan was kind of not comfortable with his protest phase. And he was like, you know, that's just the style. That's just what I was doing. I don't really believe like in it. And I'm like, wow, that's weird. Cause like people like actually took his lyrics and like, they felt like he really was living that. And then he more, as he got older, he was like, well, you know, that was just a phase I was in.
Yeah. Well, some songs you don't necessarily have to write about anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You could just throw some fun lyrics down, make them cool, put some cool sounding words and some cool rhymes in there. Sometimes that's all it needs to be.
And a
killer hook. You have to have hooks or done. You're cooked without a hook.
Yeah. The weird thing is like you get these guys like, you know, like a Dylan, he'll have like, it would be like a, I don't know. It's like a song novel. It's like a short story. You know, if you listen to Idiot Wins, like a short novel and you're like, wow. And then, but then you get a song that's like on the radio from the 50s or something, just like, you know, just has like a hook. And you're like, even like the Motown songs and the Stax soul songs, they all have these great drum patterns that are just killer. And then these really awesome hooks and then singers that actually can sing like unbelievably well. And now we're like in this age where, you know, necessarily you don't have to have, we're like in a hip hop age, you're not singing, you know, you don't have to have a 5-octave voice. So you can have all these different types of interpretations of poetry and things that maybe wouldn't have done well before, and you don't have to have a pitch perfect voice. There's so many different ways you can come at it. But like, do you like songs that are more like fun or songs that are kind of cutting and biting or have like multiple meanings, or you just go with whatever you're feeling?
Well, I'm a fan of the dramatic. So for me, a very dramatic song, I prefer that. I really do. And that doesn't mean I don't like fun songs. I have some fun songs of my own, and there's a single we'll be releasing later on that's just straight up fun. Mm-hmm. And they have their place. But for me, something with a dramatic flair always hits home, man. It always hits hard. And you know what? Like, look at the major topics in popular music. Love. Love lost. Love found. Heartache. Heartbreak. Okay? These are themes, common themes, that run through all genres of popular music, and there's a reason for that. And that all of that is dramatic.
I think that's what people interpret. Like, if you're thinking about, like, I always go back, I'm a child of the 70s, right? And I listen to something like The Carpenters.
Yeah.
And The Carpenters song, those are all like heartbreak. You know, they're all like longing and heartbreak, and they're like perfect. They're like perfect pop. But they have this kind of double meaning because the way Karen delivered the vocal, right?
Yes. That's another thing too. The dichotomy between sweetness, maybe a sweet vocal delivery, and a heavy topic.
Yeah.
You know, or happy sounding music with the lyrical content that's heavy.
Yeah.
I love that. I love it. Love it. Love it. It hit, dichotomy. You hit a home run every time. If you could come up with something like that, you're going to knock it out of the park every time.
Yeah.
You can't lose.
If your vocals can kind of really be emotional, but the lyrics are not as emotional, then
the
vocal list is actually controlling the mood.
And it does.
Yeah. And Karen used to be able to do that. Like, she could sing a happy song, but she had so much melancholy kind of inherent in her vocal.
Yeah.
Even if it was happy, it was sad.
Well, she had a troubled life.
Yeah, it came through.
as well. So you know what? That came through her vocals. And you know what? She was selling it.
Yeah, she
got selling
it.
The hell out of it.
Yeah, she got it. And I think that's always been. Yeah, I mean, the thing that you're saying is like when you get a band that can kind of maybe have a song that's very catchy, very happy, but after you read the lyrics, it's dark.
Yeah.
But because of the happy, catchy beat, people might not even know.
That's right. They don't.
As dark as it is.
And well, so, you should check out Blondie's Heart of Glass.
Yeah.
Read the lyrics. Some of the saddest lyrics I've ever read in my life. But I never really actually realized that till a few years ago. I just never really thought about it. And then I know somebody who redid the song and they did it in a minor key and they made it sad, but it's the same lyrics. And it took me like half the song to realize what the song was.
Yeah.
But it's like a dance song, but it's the saddest lyrics in the world.
That's true.
That's always a cool device, you know, as an artist, you know, I was watching a documentary on the Beatles and George Martin was talking about like sound paintings. Right. And he was like, I could have recorded the Beatles like they were in Berlin and just like a live act. But I wanted to introduce some things I had been doing with Peter Sellers Comedy Records, where I had tape loops and orchestrations and special effects.
Wow.
And so that kind of gave you like, oh, wow. And then the fact is that the Beatles had been listening to the Peter Sellers records that George Martin had produced. And so when you get the Sgt. Pepper's, that whole concept of how it is not so like they actually kind of agreed. Like, why don't we take these Peter Sellers, like theatrical techniques on these comedy records and approach it with a rock band.
Yeah.
And then actually do something in the studio that you can't do live. Right.
Right.
And then it kind of created what people can do in DAWs now. But the idea that you can use the studio as an instrument.
That's what we do. Yes. We use the studio as an instrument. We're not afraid to experiment.
Yeah. I mean, I got into making records because of Pink Floyd.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, I like performing, but to me, it's all about the studio.
Right. And I think when you really get into the music of Tokyo Teens, you're going to find a lot of drama. You're going to find some deep subjects. There's cinema in there.
Cinematic. I mean, the song we just played was very cinematic.
Yes.
I can imagine that like in a film. And it had that kind of 80s kind of big bombastic, you know, early 90s, late 80s kind of sound. And I was a big fan of Prince, you know, and I was really always interested in how he would use drums, whether they were on a Lin or using the drummers he got. He was always very focused on how to use the drums, and the sparseness of his compositions was kind of like a studio technique to kind of leave it like a demo. And then he got more expansive, like on something like Love Sexy, he layered the heck out of his D50 stuff. But there's a lot of interesting ways he would approach things, from being like super demo to super kind of Phil Spector wall of sound on something like Love Sexy. It was like he was using the D50 and he just went overboard. You know, I thought it was great. Some people thought it was too much, but you have different approaches and different songs deserve a different kind of vibe. So as you approach a song, you got to try to feel like a whole album vibe, or you just do individual songs and fit them together and put into an EP or an album.
With this collection of songs, you might could call it concept.
Concept, cool.
You could. There's going to be musical interludes in between. So, I mean, you could say that, but the songs still stand on their own individually.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So
yeah, that's pretty cool when you can do that, because I'm a big fan of the concept record from the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
Overall, I like the Pink Floyd, like Wish You Were Here, Dark Side of the Moon, The Wall.
I love The Wall. The Wall. And I got to say this, probably my all-time favorite album by Pink Floyd other than The Wall is Animals.
Animals is fantastic.
And Animals is difficult to listen to because, oh my God. I mean, I need to take a I need to take a powder or drink myself to death. It's hard to listen to. It's so emotional for me.
Well, I used to listen to it with like headsets on a vinyl in my basement.
Yeah, me too.
And I just thought it was fantastic because I was a fan of Tommy. Like, I love Tommy.
Yeah, I
love Father Senior. I love any of the rock operas that Pete would come up with. And I like the way that Pink Floyd continued that, but in this really atmospheric way. And and they went from the creely psychedelic to this atmospheric stuff. And I just like was so enthralled with their use of synthesizers and the piano arrangements, and it's just very expansive. It's kind of like where I kind of created my expansive sound concept, because I love the idea that you could go all these directions.
I do, too.
And Pink Floyd, I mean, they're doing classical, they're doing rock, they're doing, you know, a little jazz, they're doing, you know, tape experiments, like field recordings. They're just like all over the map, you know. They would put in really interesting funky rhythms and then have heavy guitar. And it's like,
Great guitar work.
Yeah, Gilmour is like unbelievable. And the bass playing is like killer. But
the guitar work that we have with Tokyo Teens, Billy's playing all the guitars. There are some videos on his YouTube channel called Freaking Out with Billy Hume. He has documented the recording process of some of the guitars. And one of the most interesting videos is where he's using a lap steel with an Ebo.
Oh, Ebo. That's pretty cool.
Oh, man. Haunting. Yeah. Haunting.
That's awesome. I used to listen to Big Country because they used to use, you know, that back in the day, they were into that. And I really liked the weird sound. They had this really interesting kind of Irish, Scottish sound that was like new wave and then very...
Big Country?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what that was on their big hit?
Yeah.
I was going to do a video about it and I studied it. They're playing Ibanez guitars, but there's an effect. It's a detuning effect. I think it was MXR or something. I got the note somewhere. But it's a specific effect unit that they had. Well, I mean, it was the way that they played, because they do these droning strings and it would sound like bagpipes.
Right.
Yeah, it was actually a detuning effect that they use. You can't buy it anymore. And even back then, it wasn't a super popular effect. And there was a very specific sound. Steve Lillywhite produced that album.
Yeah, I never knew that.
If you listen to the drums, it sounds like if you actually listen to it, it's kind of like a U2 record in a way, like the way the drums sound.
Yeah, kind of like Unforgettable Fire in a way.
Yeah, but they had kind of a specific thing, but a lot of it was like this effect.
Some kind of detuning.
God, what? I
thought it was an Ebo because it was very unique. I never really heard it anywhere else because they were like one of the only bands to do it. And then Brian Eno, like Unforgettable Fire, was doing stuff that was kind of in the same zone. But I'm just a big 80s guy, so I could probably go on and on about that.
Yeah, same here.
You guys seem to channel, like, is your vibe purposely kind of pulling from that time period, the 80s, 90s?
I don't know the answer to that question. It just is.
I think we're just doing what we like. I mean, I was in bands in the 80s. I performed through the 80s and in the 90s, and I was always doing records and in the studio, but then my career really took off in the 90s. But I always had this thing that happened for years when I was making records up into the early 2000s, where I would get people would say, well, it just sounds a little 80s to me. And I would be trying my damnedest to not sound 80s, and it would still sound 80s. So I spent years trying to not sound like the 80s. But now it's cool again.
You're free to do it.
I've got an 8-year-old son, and my 18-year-old son has been into Tears for Fears for years. He knows all the lyrics and Duran Duran and all that. So now it's nice to not hold back. So when Jim came to me and we were in bands together in the 80s and into the 90s. So I guess we're just kind of doing what we like, and it's just kind of, it's not like we're trying to sound 80s. I just think it's like what we like. You know,
it's kind of like, if that's what you are, that's what you are. Like, if you're like funkadelic, like that's funkadelic, right? And funkadelic, maybe they're not in their time anymore, right? But if when they were doing it, people, that's the zone. And if you try to get outside of that, you know, they're never going to sound as good as when they're at, you know, doing like the Tear the Roof Off. That's kind of their zone, you know. And you can try, and every artist is going to go through phases. You know,
well, the other thing is that the music business is different now. Like, for most of my career, there are very specific guidelines on what you could do as far as wanting to have any kind of success. Like, if you wanted a record deal or get to play, you know, you had rock, country, you know, dance, pop, heavy metal, and, you know, and variations within that. But there was actually gatekeepers and systems to keep you in line. Even when I was, and then when the internet started blowing up and the record industry fell apart, the idea of genres kind of fell apart now. And there's bands out there that are popular now that I challenge you to even just tell me what the genre is. Some of these bands, you can't really say what the genre is. It doesn't really matter anymore.
Yeah.
And I like that. So it's like so many of the artists I work with are blending genres, but I don't think that a lot of these people aren't, I don't think they're thinking like, oh, I'm going to blend genres.
No,
they're just doing what they like. But that was not something easily done back in the old days. Like in the old days, you had to really think about, you know, fine tune. I mean, there were so many restrictions. I mean, one of my bands, I mean, I had a black guy and another guy that was kind of part Asian. And even that was a weird thing. Like the record label's like, well, we don't know how to market you. I'm like, why? And it's like, well, you got a black guy in the group, that, you know, we got to appeal to the brothers, man. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And I couldn't believe it. But nowadays, I remember when Sum 41 became popular. I was like, well, look at that. Like it's a racially mixed group. Finally. But there were so many restrictions back then. And nowadays, it just doesn't matter. Like, you can kind of do what you want. It's a wonderful time. I think we're in a very creative time musically, as far as, you know, the world is concerned. It's a great time to be doing music.
So, like, if somebody was going to pin you down for a genre, would you be like, well, I don't want to get pinned down. It's like indie. It's, you know, alternative. It's a new way. I mean, what would you say?
It's the coolest fucking music, man. That's what it is.
Go out there and say coolest fucking music.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people would go, it sounds 80s, but I think some people would not even think. Like, I put, you know, a couple of these videos, like playing little excerpts of this music out there on my Instagram, on my YouTube, and I don't think anybody yet has said anything about the 80s. They're just like, well, that's cool.
Yeah. Well, I heard today that there has been a rebellion against some of the kind of overproduction that's going on. And people are going back to the 80s and 90s albums, and they're actually getting more play. I heard that my daughter had told me, she's like a 22-year-old. And she said, yeah, like people want to hear bands that actually composed songs.
Yeah.
You know, like the Steely Dans of the world and the Pink Floyds, and, you know, and even if you get to like a Guns N' Roses, like a band that actually could produce heavy metal, like Def Leppard, like they could do it, you know, it was like, where's the next Def Leppard? Where's the next, Axl Rose? You don't see that as much, but in the underground, I have, you know, interviewed bands in Germany that channel like Guns N' Roses. They're doing like a new Guns N' Roses, but they're super small, right? They love that sound and they're doing it. Or they're doing like a Deep Purple, or there's so many like underground bands. They're like, okay, I like that. And that's what I'm going to do. And it seems like the gatekeepers don't want to let it go through, but in the underground of the SoundClouds of the world and the YouTubes and all the other places, these bands are getting audiences. They're getting on Instagram. They're getting followers. They're touring. They're making success. And that's why I try to do this podcast, to kind of show people that there is a scene outside of the top 10, top 20, that there's still stuff going on that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't know how strong the gatekeepers are now. Like, probably in the last couple of years, probably half the songs that ended up on the top of the charts started on TikTok, and it was just people just screwing around, you know? Like, this one producer I follow on Instagram, he made a beat and said, hey, put something over this, and people would, like, do something with their cell phone, and one of them blew up and became a top 10 hit, and it was just, I mean, it was like rap music or something like that, but I just think that if you can do something that's cool, people respond to it. Like, you know, like people just, you know, there's really nobody to hold you back if you can get out there and get a following. you know, because it was all about distribution. In the old days, it was all about control of the radio stations and control of the distribution channels. You couldn't even put a record or a CD in a store unless it was like a little mom and pop shop, mm-hmm. unless you went through official channels, and then there's all this other stuff involved. But now, if you can put a video out online and it's good and you can get people to watch it, you can blow up. And I mean, you know, there's nobody stopping you, it kind of except yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting is that they know that you can, if you feel like you don't have to change who you inherently are as a musician to try to tap into a wave, you can say, you know what, Tokyo Teens, you are Tokyo Teens and you're going to do what you want. And the audience, yep. the way the world is, if you're on Instagram, people all over the world will hear you, you know, and you get on a reel, you get mm-hmm. on TikTok, you get on YouTube, everybody mm-hmm. in the world, your whole audience, you know, is like, you know, everywhere.
Yes.
And so that opens up a gate that, you know, the gatekeepers can't stop that. That's where you can get invited to play in Dubai. You could be playing in London. You could be playing in, you know, Argentina, just because there's a scene, you know, you get an agent and they're like, well, yeah, there's a scene in Argentina and they like you. Then you can go.
Yes. Yes. You're right. And the entire world is just right there at your fingertips. You don't have to go anywhere. You do all the hard work yourself at home, as far as promotion, like something like that, Instagram or, you know, TikTok. They're right there waiting for you. All you have to do is work your ass off and take advantage of that. It's your career. You need to bust your ass and get somewhere. And you can. If you work hard enough, you'll get there. Because just like you said, Phantom, there are people that want to hear your music, right? There are people that are going to understand what you as an artist, any artist, what you're doing. But you have to get it out there. And nobody's going to work harder than you.
Well, hopefully.
You need to be you need to be busting your own ass, and then other people will hop on board.
Yeah.
Okay. But you have to have, if you just do what you do and do it well, all right, and work your butt off, okay, you're going to get some momentum and you're going to get somewhere with it.
Yeah. I think what happens is like people, like they, you know, what I found is like, I've always been into like a certain kind of aesthetic that where I feel it's like honest, like where I got driven to guys like Paul Westerberg and Bob Mould and Grant Hart and stuff like that. And, you know, Ian Curtis, because I felt like mm-hmm. You felt like when they're doing it, they weren't trying to be some big star. They just felt like,
no,
it's real.
Being a star. That's not the name of the game, right? You're just doing what you do.
Oh, wait, I thought we were trying to be stars. We are?
Wait a minute. All right, let me take a note. I was on the wrong track.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with trying to be a star, because you want to be like a Freddie Mercury, you want to be a Prince, you want to be a Michael Jackson. You know, there's some people, like, they're so driven. Like, you know, the whole thing with Prince was he did, broke all the rules. He, like, multiple genre, multiple different styles on one record. You know, have a band that's like multiracial and had women in it. And, mm-hmm. you know, he's doing all these things you're not supposed to do. And then, you know, eventually Warner's getting a fight with him because he finally started hitting the wall and say, yeah, I want to do this. And he's like, no, he's like, mm-hmm. I still want to do it. You know, and it's just, but I think like everybody, I always thought that was a great story in terms of, you know, he's 17 and they let him produce his own record.
Yeah.
You know, and he just kind of forced it because it is his own pure will of, I want to be as big as I can be. And he learned every freaking instrument and he just did it. And I was like, damn.
Yeah.
That was like a Hendrix thing to me. And I always looking at a guy being an African-American, I'm looking like guys like Hendrix. And, you know, if you think about Lead Belly and Robert Johnson, I was always driven to like, these are awesome people. Even Stevie Wonder, you know, all the Motown guys. It was always like, they just kicked ass. And so you just kick ass, like you're saying, and you believe it, you just do it. You know, you just try to be the best you can be, and just your audience will come to you.
Yes, yes. I mean, they're out there. They're waiting for you. You just have to go out there and get them. Let them know that you're here. But if you sit around and just think about it, they're never going to find you, man.
Well, I think also
they're not going to know who you are.
You think it's like also, do you find like an artist, if you spend too much time like in the lab, trying to make the most perfect thing, instead of trying things and maybe too scared to try things and put different things out there, right? So a lot of young artists today, they'll throw things against the wall, right? They'll throw it up on SoundCloud, they'll throw it on TikTok. They don't know if it's good. They don't know if it's perfect. They just do it. And there's an old school thing of, look, I'm going to spend a year trying to get this one track, like to be born like Born to Run. Yeah. I'm going to spend a year on this track, like Born to Run. There's a place to do that. And I still think there are bands that will do that. But what do you think about that kind of dichotomy?
Well, you know, he was probably working on other songs at the same time as Born to Run. You know, I feel like you're touching on something that I think that's important. And it was a big thing with me about becoming a producer. I spent so much time wanting to be really good and wondering if I was worthy. And then I look around and I realize there's guys out there calling themselves producers and getting work, and they're not even as good as me. And I don't even think they think about whether they're good or not. They're just doing it. It kind of comes down to a very simple thing. Either you do it or you don't. And, you know, going into rap music, when I started doing rap music, it was kind of a big wake up call for me, because these guys, like, there would be times in the studio where I'd be working, and I always have like a bunch of guitars around the studio, right? Mm-hmm. And they would look around and see these guitars and not say anything. And at some point I might pick up a guitar and they'd go, "Oh, wow, you actually play it." I'm like, "Yeah, they thought it was for decoration." But then what would happen is I would start playing guitar on something and I'd do something cool. And more than once, one of these guys would look at me and go, "Wow, it's like art."
It's art.
And at first it kind of bothered me, but I actually found it kind of liberating, because I realized that for years I'd been taking my, I'm definitely an artist and I'm into art, but it's easy to take yourself too seriously. Mm-hmm. And these guys were just trying to have a hit song, and they're just trying to make something that could make them some money. So they didn't think of it as art. And I thought that was kind of liberating for me. It's like, oh, I don't have to take myself seriously. We can just have fun and we can just do something catchy. But the funny thing is when you quit thinking about it as art, you're actually more likely to create something artistically unique than when you're spending so much time thinking about being an artist. It was this amazing thing for me where I just felt like some of my best work was with a bunch of guys that were not thinking about it as art. They think of it more like they're an athlete, like they're a free agent baseball player or something like that. And I just wanted to hit a home run. And to me, that was like so liberating. And the other thing with rap music I found interesting is that those guys are always in the studio. Like I would have clients that literally had an album come out on a Wednesday, the album they've been working on for a year. And on Thursday, they're back in the studio working on new songs. I mean, they're gigging too.
Yeah.
But the idea of constantly
writing.
Yeah, you can't. If you think about Picasso worked all the time and painted an insane amount of pictures. And it's just a numbers game. You just got to do a lot of it. But I've met people like, "Well, I've been working on this one song for a year." I'm like, "Well, fucking good luck, man." Because you like, I look at it this way, like, no matter what you're doing in life, probably 9 times out of 10, you're going to fail. Like people look at my discography and they go, "Wow, you've been so successful." But what they don't realize is that the discography that I show the public is maybe 5% of my work or less. I mean, the vast majority of what I've done has commercially failed, or even to some degree, like just even artistically, I mean, that were just failures, but you got to do a lot of work. So if you're going to fail 9 times out of 10, you got to go ahead and get those failures out of the way. So when I'm doing something, if I fail at something, instead of being depressed, I'm like, "Well, shit, that one's dead. Only 8 more to go."
I think that's a really interesting thing, because I think that's why Prince had the output he did. He was pretty much recording every day. And I kind of look at the old school, you know, what was going on in Motown, is people would just be writing all the time trying to get the hit. And if it didn't work, give it to another band. If it didn't work, you know, give it to this band, give it to Four Tops, give it to Temptations, give it to Martha and Vandellas. They just keep on rotating around, change it around here, change it there. They just kept on producing. You know, the Funk Brothers would just produce and produce and produce and all day.
Yes.
You know, and in a way I look at it with like Prince, you know, I've been listening to everything he ever did. I'm a fanatic. And he just wouldn't stop recording. you know, they made his house the studio. His house was his studio. Mm-hmm. So he could just come into to a crazy high level studio and just record every day. And he did. And he's got like thousands and thousands of like songs that are as good as anything he ever did. And nobody's ever heard it. And, that was kind of why you saw the output he had, is because of that story where Billy was saying, it's like he had so much output that you got a piece of it.
Yeah. And you have to constantly work constantly. I mean, that's why we're excited. This new album will have 112 songs on it. So we're we're working all the time, baby.
is this an EP or a full album?
Well, this will be an EP. And I don't know, we have at least two singles. There may be three singles, and then we'll just release the rest of it with the singles as an EP, maybe something like that.
Yeah, again, it seems, what do you think of the way the playlist world is? It seems like you have to be in a singles market, kind of like in the 50s.
Yes, you're exactly right about that. And you know what? That's okay. Cool.
Yeah, I think it's cool to give the customer or to give the band, to give the fans. I think the fans want to see the bands like actually put out like every month if they can. You know, I've seen a lot of people, they want to, if they're into their band, they'll, you know, the band might put out a mixtape and then they'll put out their official record and then they put out something underground, like on some other format. And people are willing to go after it, especially in the weird, I heard people like saying, oh, the album's dead. But then if you go into hip hop, there are concept albums all over the place.
Yeah.
They're like 60-minute, 70-minute albums within the hip hop world, actually gaining traction and people listening to them. So it's just kind of like, you guess you just have to be interesting enough to gate that audience to listen that long.
Well, it's wide open, Phantom. It's wide open. So it's pretty much anything goes. You put out what you want to put out. You should be releasing singles, first of all. But aside from that, if you want to do a double album, do a double album. Didn't, I don't know, the country artist Morgan Wallen?
That was a double album.
Wasn't that someone number one forever? So, you know what I mean? I don't know that there's a formula or a rule.
Yeah, I think the rules are gone. I think, I mean, because like if somebody says, oh, you can't do a Bohemian Rhapsody type of thing anymore, you can't do that. And then somebody will go out and do it, right? And then, you can only do 2 minute songs because that's what the audience deals with.
Tell us not to do something and you're going to get it right back in your face. All right.
That punk aesthetic.
So don't even be putting rules or any of that on us. Yeah. We're not playing that. And we're breaking a lot of rules on these records. Mm-hmm. We're breaking rules. So we're blending genres. We're blending ideas. We're blending concepts together, and it's so exciting. I just can't wait for everybody to hear what we've done.
What's the target date for the first hit to drop?
That's a good question.
First single. Well, I got to finish mixing it first.
It's in the mixing stage. He's mixing it right now.
I'll probably be done in a couple days, but I don't.
We still have to
get it out there. You're saying like by summertime or?
Oh yeah.
We got to get on the ball.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause once that drops, everything else will get mixed. I mean, we have to, you know, there's a small amount of recording to do. Not much. We'll fill holes, you know.
Are you going to make like, I saw the video you made. Are there official like music videos for the songs or are you going to tour it?
They're going to be live shows. We'll probably just, there'll be a lyric video and then an official video for the first single called Forever.
Okay, I saw that. You're announcing that on Instagram. I saw that.
Yes. So that'll be the first single. And then we'll have videos for that. And then, we're just going to roll with it after that. I don't know what the next single release after that will be. We haven't really decided.
Yeah, it's such a new project. It's kind of like you come up with a game plan and then you start going forward and then everything's going to change and we'll adjust.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like some bands I work with that put out multiple albums and toured and they already kind of know what their audience is and what works and what doesn't, but we're at the stage where like, we don't know. And I don't really care right now. Just as long as we start putting it out, we'll figure it out as we go. I don't really, I just think that, you know, coming up with a plan's cool, but it's going to all change once we start doing it. But main thing is getting it out there. To be honest with you, nothing that I've actually planned ever worked out, ever. I've never had a plan work out. But what ends up happening is that I go out there, the plan fails, but it triggers other things to happen. And then I'm smart enough to, or I don't know if I'm smart, but I know that the plan's going to fail. So what I do is I start, the plan fails, but I see what came of it and I go, well, let's try this instead. It's always worked that way. It's kind of funny. Like, that's why I don't even like to talk about shit because it's going to fail. So why talk about it?
You put something out there and you let the wind kind of take you where the wind's going to take you. Right. So I think that's what sometimes you get an audience and then suddenly you find out that this is hitting like in Berlin. So that's where I need to go because that's where my main audience is. Right. So you could say, well, I'm going to go do here. But then it's like Berlin's the only place it's really hitting. So maybe I really need to just go there.
Yes. But yes.
You don't know that until you actually put it out and then see it. Then you're like, okay, now I know what I can do. And okay, right. I can do that. So yeah, I can understand. You kind of got to be on your feet and be nimble enough to not get locked into anything because the way the world is, I mean, you could end up going to Dubai, you could end up going to, you know, into like the Netherlands or Iceland, because there's a bunch of people in Iceland like dig you and they're like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll go there. You know, you just kind of go.
Well, it's just fluid. It's fluid. We don't know. No one knows. So we'll just roll with whatever happens. But there's already been so much positive feedback already. And we haven't released the first song yet. It's amazing. We're so thankful that people are reaching out to us and people are so excited.
Well, you got a great sound. I mean, the sound that I heard and is just something I think is what I don't hear enough. I mean, I've been a child of the 70s and a big fan of the 80s, 90s. Yeah. And I think you can't go wrong with that kind of big beat. And the kind of the atmospheric like sense, you know, the rolling sounds,
right.
I was hearing, not to be a guy to push that, because I mean, I like DX7s, I like, yeah, like, you know, Prophets, I like Oberheims, I like pretty much anything that serves the song. So as a synthesis, like, okay, if this song needs an Oberheim, this song needs a Prophet, this song needs a Jupiter.
Yeah, you're right. You serve the song.
Yeah, it's like if I need a Jupiter 8 sound, I'll go with a Jupiter. If I wanted a weird, crazy sound like a Jupiter 6 because it's really weird, it doesn't act like any other Roland, and like that one, I'll go with that one because it does really weird kind of discordant things. And it's like you know, you just kind of take the tools that you need to do where your head's at. So if I'm very discordant today, so I'm gonna use a Jupiter 6 because that kind of is its main feature is it can go there. You kind of take whatever you got. It's like a guitarist, it's like you're gonna pick the guitar that has the tone that fits your mood
that you need,
what you're trying to drive, you know, or the pedal or the amp that's doing what you want it to do. I mean, so when you get into like your guitar phases, that you've got like favorite guitars over the years that you've collected that you use for certain tones?
Well, I mostly use where the hell did it go? Oh, can you hand me that? This is actually my main guitar here. This is a Bill Lawrence guitar. Bill Lawrence made pickups, and I bought this in the 80s because it's got these stacked double coils. They look like Fender pickups, but they're actually stacked double coils. Now, this is a customized Mullinax pickup. It's a guy here in Atlanta, and he doesn't even have a shop. He just makes them for people. But this guitar... it's been my main guitar for years. It's like my favorite guitar. And I think I bought it for like $800, but then you could find them in pawn shops for $50 because nobody knew what they are. They're great guitars. I haven't seen one in decades. I mean, they were not common guitars. And then I play, can you hand me that right there? Yeah. The Telecaster.
Okay. I like Telecaster.
Now, this guitar here, there's a funny story. So I've got two studios. We're in my home studio now. My other studio is my old home. I had to move out. But that's where I did a bunch of records. But I had a couple studios there. And in one of the studios, like I work in the basement. The whole basement's a studio. But I had another studio upstairs that a lot of the big rap records I did were recorded there. But I had a producer that rented it out for a couple of years. And this guitar was hanging up in the wall in there. So I just figured it was his guitar. When he moved out, I said, hey, man, I called him up and said, you left your Telecaster. He said, that's not mine. That was just in the studio. I'm like, oh, shit. I don't even know where this thing came from. But it's actually a Korean-made Telecaster. It's for Fender, but it was one of their cheaper brands, the Korean version. Mm-hmm. But it's so well made that people started buying these instead of the expensive American-made ones. It's got like a through-body neck on it.
Oh, wow.
This thing plays rare. Dude, this thing plays amazing. So Fender has this thing, like if you know the serial number, you can look it up online and find out like what anything about your guitar, but you can't find any of these guitars on there. They took them off the date. They don't even admit they made these things. It's this weird brand. And I looked it up online and there's like a whole culture behind these Korean made Fender guitars. This thing's amazing, but it literally was just showed up at my studio, but was not uncommon. Things would show up at my studio all the time. I would find a guitar. I found a mic pre, but then I would like find pants, but I never saw anybody leaving their underwear. So I don't know where that came in.
That story comes from.
The pants were there, but nobody left in their underwear. The weirdest things would show up at my studio and like even like filming gear. Like I've got that weird adapter that I'm always using. I don't know. It's a nice adapter. It just showed up one day.
People show up.
Bob
from accounting spent 3 weeks there.
Weird things happen at the studio. That's for sure.
So it's like this whole Tokyo Teens. I never had thought to ask you, like, why did you choose that name? Is there a story behind the name you chose for the band?
Well, not really. It's just I thought it sounded cool, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the music.
Yeah, I noticed.
It doesn't mean anything.
You ain't from Tokyo and you ain't a teen.
I ain't been a teen in a long time, baby.
Perfect.
It's just one of those things where it's like it's the opposite of what you think it is.
It's the opposite. It really doesn't mean anything, but it's memorable.
Yeah, yeah.
It looks cool. You know.
Yeah, my kids don't like it.
What's wrong with them?
Because, well, I mean, they're really into Japanese music and culture and stuff like that. So they think somehow we're like
making fun of it or something.
I don't know what they. Well, my kids think I'm an idiot anyway. But
you're a silly old man.
I'm a silly old man. No, they just they're kind of like they've not actually come out and said anything. But they give me disapproving looks if I ever say the name.
Well, I'm going to beat them with a 2x4.
I got a 2x4 right back here. You can borrow it. Just kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll use a brick then. But yeah, so it means not. It doesn't mean anything. It just sounds cool.
That's cool.
It'll look cool on a T-shirt. By the way, we'll have plenty of T-shirts for $25 coming up. So hey.
Yeah, that's always the thing you got to do today. The thing is crazy. Like if you think about the way the Spotify world or the streaming world.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I go to New York and I got like 100 T-shirts. I'll make more money than I made on my Spotify for like 6 months. You know, because you can sell a poster, you can sell like a CD that you went and made yourself with some company, and you can do better. And that's kind of sad that you can't monetize directly your music at the level. But I guess even back in the day, you weren't really monetizing because you're selling it, and the record company was giving you like 10 cents for an $8.
Yeah, album. But I still made more money when there were record labels. I made more money back then for sure because music is now, the labels were ripping people off, but they were making a lot of money. So even with us getting ripped off, we were still making money. But now music is basically free now. You know, it gets paid for, but it's not like people are going to the store and buying music. So it's not like the money that used to be in this business is not.
The only way you seem to monetize, what I found is like, you got a sync license. You got to sync license your stuff. Like I found a way to get my stuff if you get on the different gaming sites like Twitch, I actually got a deal with BMI to license my stuff on Twitch. So I get paid like a higher royalty rate than I do on Spotify. If some gamer uses my music in his background, my rate is higher than I would streaming on Spotify or iTunes. And that's how you can get stuff like that where you can actually get a better deal.
And you can make good money touring. I mean, some of the groups I work with tour a lot, and live music is very popular now. Like, people love to go see bands. So the whole live thing is great right now. And so a lot of bands are doing good with that. But the thing is, if you can sell your music or make money off streaming or whatever, and you're doing it on your own, the overall income might not be as good as it used to be, but since you own it, you have more control, your actual ratio of what you're getting is way higher.
Yeah.
Because in the old days, like, you would have to sell a lot of records to make, I mean, the thing a lot of people don't realize is that very few artists actually made a ton of money in the music. You would think they made a lot of money because they were famous, but they weren't really making that kind of money. Like, very few people made the kind of money everybody thought they made.
Yeah, because they're all giving you like advances and then saying you got to make it back. Like, and maybe your first record hit a big number, but then they expected your next record to hit the same as the first record. And how is that going to happen? Like if you like an example, like Prince, he did like 8 million, 10 million on Purple Rain, but then Around the World in a Day did like 2. And Warner's is acting like Around the World in a Day should have got the same as Purple Rain. So now we're not going to give you the money because we already gave you an advance, so you're not going to get anything.
So
I mean, that's kind of the way it works, is because, like, how are you ever going to get back? Like, once in a while, you'll get a band like the Eagles or something, they'll suddenly boom, they hit something. But then, like, you know, the long run didn't do what, you know, what the Hotel California did. And it was never going to do that.
The long run was a great album.
It's a good album, but it was never going to hit that number. And then if you're measured on getting that number, then you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Numbers. But, going back to what you were saying, numbers.
Yeah. Well, it's just best to try to do it on your own.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. Well, that's what we're doing here. We're doing all of this ourselves.
Well, I think doing it yourself, you know, the do it yourself kind of mentality today. And, you know, it's in rap. And the thing about hip hop that you've kind of spoken to is, like, hip hop is a lot of people just had a lot of heart and they got a lot of drive and they want to do it. And they might not, they didn't go to Berkeley and they don't, a lot of times they don't know how to play an instrument. But they got a feel, right? And they might have the lyrical content and they've got the presence. Maybe they got a stage presence. They got a personality that can carry it through. So if they get in a video and they can present themselves, they got like that stagecraft. And so you're okay. Well, that's always been kind of in rock. There's always been the guy that has the stage presence that can kind of push it. And you're like, okay. And then, okay, well, that's what we can do. We can take that stage presence and knock it out the park like a Bowie, you know? And they put Bowie on stage and turn him into, you know, Aladdin Sane. He becomes the Ziggy. And he just, you know, the Thin White Duke, he just became that. And if he was trying to be just David Jones, it didn't work. Nobody went to see David Jones, but they went to see Ziggy. They went to see the Thin White Duke. You know, so I think in rap, it's kind of like these guys create this persona. And maybe it's not who they really are, or maybe it is. But I think it's kind of hyperbolic, and that's how you get through. You know, I think you can learn that. You can take that, whether you're a rapper or an EDM guy or a rock guy, you take that and you kind of like, well, I can kind of take that and use it.
Well, I think now they're calling it branding.
Yeah.
That's very important. You know, I mean, we kind of laugh at that, but it's very important to let people know who you are. I mean, whether it's a created character or not, it doesn't matter. You have to be something. Mm-hmm. You can't have zero identity. So you've got to figure that out, and you have to give that to the people so they know who you are and what you're about.
It is the entertainment business.
Yes, it's right. It's called entertainment. You
better be entertaining. Yeah, my thing is, I realized that a couple times that I was actually more interesting than my clients.
That's a red flag.
That's a problem. And I've got more stories and I'm more dynamic. Like, you know, if I'm working with somebody and they keep interrupting me because they got more stories and it pisses me off, I know they're probably going to do well. But if sit there politely and listen to me, there's something wrong.
There's something. You don't want them to sit there and say
like,
nothing.
Like you're just sitting there listening to me blab. Dude, say something, man. I can't be the only one telling all the stories here.
Yeah.
But it's got to be entertaining.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I think that's why I did well as a producer. I mean, I had my own bands, but when I got into production and mixing, that showmanship never left me. So I never really thought about it as putting on a show. But I think that's part of why my clients like me and why people believed in me, because I was doing good work, but it was kind of like the Billy Hume show in the studio too.
It still is.
Oh, well, it still is. Yeah.
I mean,
things happen. That's all I'm going to say.
Things do happen.
Things happen.
And there's a nice, and Billy made a nice documentary about us doing some of the recording here. It's on his YouTube channel, Freaking Out with Billy Hume. It's called In the Studio with Billy Hume and Tokyo Teens. Well, it's about a 25-minute documentary about us being crazy and doing some of the recording here. It's very interesting if anybody wanted to look that up.
Well, I can actually link it when this gets published, it can have multiple links. And doesn't just have one or two. So if you have that direct link, send it to me real quick and I can add it into the publication of this when it goes to Spotify.
Oh man, that'd be great. Yes, yeah, very interesting. And so you can see some of the crazy stuff that we do. And we do have fun. I mean, that's the bottom line. You want to have fun. You don't want to get in here and be miserable.
Yeah.
We like to have a good time. And we do. And we've known each other for many years.
That was the thing about like when I went from rap music and I went into country music, they're not a whole lot of fun in the studio. I mean, they're not a drag, it's just like a job. Everybody goes and then they leave. And I'm used to rap sessions where
they last all night.
Yeah, we're working, but there's a part where everybody stops and everybody has this conversation or just things happen, you know, where things are unexpected or we work on one song and things head in another direction and who knows what's going to happen. But on country sessions, it's all very
straight up.
It's like a job.
They look at their watches. It's time to go.
Well, yeah. Well, so it's very regimented and sessions are limited to 3 hours. There's nobody drinking. There's nobody smoking. I mean, what kind of fucking session is that, man?
That's the Nashville rule?
Yeah. I mean, I've done some work in Nashville. But even the independent country guys, they can be a little cooler, but it's still kind of viewed more as a task or a job as opposed to a lifestyle. Because, you know, I mean, they tend to be more live musicians, so they're not in the studio all the time. Whereas with other genres, you're in the studio all the time, and it's part of the culture. And that was one of the things I liked about rap music, was that it was studio-based, and they understood that you're using the studio as an instrument.
Yeah, and they're still doing the Beatles thing, even though they're a totally different genre, but they're using the Beatles concept.
Yes, definitely.
Yes, you're right.
Everybody said I was a hard worker when I was younger, and I believed them until I started working with Lil Jon. Then I started to understand what hard work really was.
Well, I think it's interesting to be able to cross genre, because that's really part of what I love. I try to, you know, throw in the idea of expansive sound is that, you know, one day I could be doing Channel and Sun Ra. And next day I could be channeling and like, you know, some Lead Belly, or I could be doing some like Queen, or I mean, I can go anywhere I want to go, because I'm not telling people I'm just EDM. I'm just trance. I'm just electronic. I could be punk. I could be Husker Du.
Mm-hmm. We know that you're big fans of Yes and the progressive bands of the 70s.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. If you think about like, Yes is like a big, big draw for me just because I like those like 10-minute, 20-minute songs.
Yeah.
I tend to go there. Right. And when I go live, people like that. The people who want to hear the Ghost, they like to see somebody still kind of doing the Keith Emerson, doing that kind of thing, because they want to see that. Because that when you go out, do you just want to see somebody jumping up and down on a MIDI controller? Or do you want to see somebody like jamming out on a mini mode?
Right.
Or on a B3. You know, I'd rather see Greg Allman on his Hammond any day. And I did go see him all the time. because that's what I like, jam bands. So I mean, I would go see Funkadelic, I would go see the Allmans, and I would sit there and go see three Allman shows in back to back.
Yeah,
just because watching Dickie Betts and watching those guys, like, that's it. That's what I like, you know. And that's you know, that's personally my choice. I think there's some cool hip hop out there where people have done some really interesting things. I like this guy Earl Sweatshirt. I think he's an unbelievable rapper in terms of his lyrical density. So there's some really cool stuff out there, but I'm still like an old school guy, kind of.
Bernie Worrell.
Bernie Worrell is the guy.
Yeah. Yes. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, anything he touched, I mean, hip hop is using his licks every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Isley Brothers.
Oh, yeah. Isley Brothers. I mean, Hendrix, I have some Hendrix stuff with them. I got some songs where Hendrix was playing with them. And he'd be in a Chitlin' circuit. He was doing backup.
Oh, I think I knew that. Maybe I forgot. I heard that before. Yeah.
I actually have some tracks, and you can hear him channeling like Are You Experienced type chord changes on an Isley Brothers song.
Wow.
And it's like before he ever hit big. And that's why he got like kicked out of the band, because he kept on throwing his licks that didn't really fit where
Ernie must have kicked his ass. You're out of here.
Why are you showboating? Why are you showboating?
I remember, man, when this album "Go for Your Guns" came out, the album cover. So it's like stage, and there's smoke and everything everywhere. And I heard "Go for Your Guns," and dude, that album just blew my mind.
Yeah, I mean,
I loved them so much.
Yeah, they're unbelievable. But yeah. So I think we kind of hit our mark. We always go by an hour, but it's like, it's always fun. I love to just talk to bands. I get a good vibe, and you guys got a cool vibe.
You know, thank you.
I think you guys are going to be really, you've actually hit a time where the audience wants what you're doing, in my opinion. And I think you're going to be very happy with the audience response with you guys when you guys play live. And I would love to see you guys if you come around New York or something. Because I'm in that Northeast, so.
Well, we'll make sure you're there. We'll take care of you, definitely.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. We enjoyed it. Thanks for having us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been nice talking to you, man. You're a cool dude. We'd love to do this again if you'll have us back at some point. Oh, yeah. We'd love to come back for sure.
We do multiple shows, so like if you guys have something you want to present, like when your EP is ready, I'm not opposed to doing an album release episode if you're into it.
Oh, man, that'd be great. Yes, we definitely love to do that. We'll put it in the books.
Yep. Yeah,
definitely.
I love that. I love to do that. I've done that a bunch of times with, like, you know, emerging artists, and you guys, that would be really cool for me. That would be an honor to actually be able to get that out for you.
We'll do it.
Okay, thank you guys. Have a good night.
All right, you too. Thank you. See you, everybody.